All right, we welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We do only have one case on our oral argument docket. It's ex parte Jacob Brian Evans. I understand counsel have checked in with our clerk. If you will please announce counsel and who they'll be arguing for. All right, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Good morning. Good morning.
I'm Larry Moore, and I and Max Smith represent the appellant who was the applicant in the writ of habeas corpus proceeding below, Mr. Jacob Brian Evans. This appeal from the writ hearing, from the writ application, contains 2 points of error. The first deals with the denial of the requested relief that he be discharged from custody regarding the capital murder charge, and the second dealing with the reasonableness of the amount of bond that was set. There are subpoints to each of those. I'd like to address the first point first. And at the onset, either Mr. Llewellyn or I, one of us, is horribly wrong in this case, because the positions that we take are completely in opposite. My writ application was not an application asking the court to find that this punishment for capital murder as applies to a 17-year-old is unconstitutional. That horse has already left the gate. The Supreme Court has told us that you can't execute him and you can't give him life without parole. My writ application was a request from the court to give effect to that those opinions by discharging him from custody for those offenses. The state in its brief goes on for pages, indicating that this was not a claim that was cognizable by writ of habeas corpus, that it's not a claim that was ripe for adjudication, and that to rule on the merits would give an advisory opinion. None of that applies. We already know that it's unconstitutional. In matter of fact, the courts of appeals here in Texas have, in response to that Supreme Court opinion, remanded these cases back for new punishment hearings. There's not any question that the punishments for capital murder as applied to a 17-year-old are unconstitutional. The issue for this court, and actually the issue for the trial court, was how and when do we give effect to that? By what means do we give effect to those Supreme Court holdings? There's no mechanism that I'm aware of. You know, the state suggests in its brief that it's not right for the issue's not right for review until he is actually sentenced to an unconstitutional sentence. To me, that's ludicrous. I don't know how you can compel somebody to go forward in a trial for which everybody in the country knows there's no possible punishment that is constitutionally permissible, and require him to be sentenced to an unconstitutional punishment to say that his claim is then ripe for review. If that's the case, none of the law that we talk about in the briefs regarding the types of claims that are cognizable on pretrial writs of habeas corpus would apply. Ex parte Matthews talks about, you know, the different types of claims that might be cognizable on a pretrial writ, and talks about those where the statute is void on its face, the caption type cases. It talks about tolling provisions of the statute of limitations being unconstitutional and being a ground that is cognizable on a pretrial writ. It talks about an indictment that's barred on its face by the statute of limitations. Double jeopardy, collateral estoppel. All of those are types of claims that have been held to be cognizable on a pretrial writ of habeas corpus. And to indicate that you would have to be sentenced pursuant to the offense before you could raise those cases, but raise those types of claims, flies in the face of all that jurisprudence. It just doesn't make sense.
Okay, Larry, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Suppose this were a Class C misdemeanor that had as the only possible punishment fine and no jail time, and the person were declared indigent. What would be your remedy then?
Well, if the punishment's unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional. I don't care if it's a fine or if it's the death.
So isn't that the case law we should be looking at? The I mean, you can't keep an indigent person in jail for failure to pay a fine for an offense that carries no jail time. Am I wrong on the law?
No, and I agree with that. In my mind, that may be a little bit different of a question, because you're talking about his financial ability to discharge the sentence as opposed to the propriety of the sentence. But I understand what the court is saying. There is an old case out of the Court of Criminal Appeals back from 1969 that I did not cite in the brief because I just found it this weekend, but I will provide the cite. It's White versus State, 440 Southwest 2nd, 660. It's a 1969 case. And in White, what happened is there was an amendment to the statute. And in amending the statute, they did away with punishments for some of the offenses. And what the Court of Criminal Appeals says is, if there's not a punishment for the offense, then it is not enforceable in a criminal proceeding. Very simple. You cannot enforce, even though you've got an offense on the books, if there's not a punishment, it's not enforceable by a criminal proceeding. And I apologize. I will provide a letter to the court bringing that forward. But I thought that was an interesting thing.
In that case, was it raised by a writ of habeas corpus?
No.
Raised by a motion to quash the...
It was raised... It was a caption error, and it was raised by motion to quash. It was a post-conviction appeal, and the court said that based on the issue, the fact that there was no statutory punishment, the court should have granted the motion to quash. And the court was reversed on that basis. Interestingly, the state cites in its brief this court's opinion in Butler versus State. And Butler was a complaint under Apprendi that the trial court entered a finding after an assault case that it was a family violence offense. And the complaint in Butler was that the trial court shouldn't have the authority to enter that finding, that it should have been submitted to the jury as the ultimate finder of fact on that issue. What this court indicated was that complaint was not right because it was dependent upon his punishment was not increased in that particular case, even though there was conditions of probation that were brought about by the finding and so forth. The majority of the court indicated
there was a dissent, wasn't there?
I'm sorry?
There was a dissent, wasn't there?
There was, by you, Your Honor.
Yeah, I thought.
Well reasoned. The majority of the court indicated that the complaint was not right because it depended upon the hypothetical situation wherein the defendant might be convicted of a subsequent crime, and that provision, that finding of a prior conviction of family violence would be used to enhance his punishment in the second proceeding. What the majority ruled in that particular case was that the proper time to raise that complaint was at the time of the indictment or the filing of the second charge. Now, admittedly, the court didn't say whether it was by pretrial writ of habeas corpus or by motion to quash, but they did indicate that that's when the complaint is to be made. In the appellate's brief, we cite a case called Gonzalez. There's another case, Ex Parte Weis, which we cite. Both of them indicate that there is a consideration to be made. You don't waste judicial resources in requiring litigants to go forward in a situation where you know or there's very good possibility that there's going to be a successful complaint. In Gonzalez, it was a double jeopardy claim, and they said, and actually it was the state raising the issue in Gonzalez, says the state has an interest in not wasting judicial resources if the double jeopardy claim has merit. And the same rationale applies here. It does not make sense that in order to raise this claim, the defendant, the applicant, has to go to trial and be found guilty and sentenced to an unconstitutional punishment. It defies logic that would be the case.
Couldn't you raise the claim by a motion to quash?
Yes, you can raise the claim by motion to quash, and the issue becomes, is that the appropriate thing to do? If the court denies the motion to quash, do we go forward and require that he be sentenced in connection with an unconstitutional sentence in order to perfect the appeal? And I think that this is exactly the type of situation that the pretrial writ of habeas corpus is intended to apply. to keep us from being in that situation. That's the reason I cite that portion of the code of judicial, the canons of judicial conduct. You know, we got to be true to the law. The judges have to be true to the law. And what I've asked the court, trial court to do, and what I'm asking this court to do is exactly that. There's no issue regarding the constitutionality of these statutes. At the time this crime was committed, there was no constitutional punishment for this defendant. The Miller case was decided in June of last year. The offense is alleged to have occurred in October. At the time, if he was some criminal mastermind to where he knew that Roper had decided that you couldn't give somebody the death penalty and Miller had been decided indicating that you can't give somebody life without parole, then he would know at the time in October of the alleged commission of the crime, there was no constitutional penalty. But that it just defies logic. And I don't know, you know, we spent a lot of time in the briefs, or at least the state did, discussing whether or not this is an as-applied challenge to constitutionality or it's a facial challenge. I did not intend, nor do I envision, the writ application as being a challenge to the constitutionality. As I indicated, that issue's settled. What I envisioned the issue at the writ application was, how does the court give effect to it? And I, you know, as an academic matter, whether it's an as-applied challenge that fits within a very narrow set of exceptions that would allow us to go forward on that basis, or whether it's a facial challenge, because certainly anybody that's 17 years old, you know, these statutes are not constitutional as applied to them. I don't know the answer to that, but I know it's got to be one or the other. There's just it does not make sense that we would be required to go forward under these circumstances. If there's
what
no other questions,
unlawful restraint.
Do what?
What about unlawful restraint?
Well, the unlawful restraint is he's being called to answer for a case where there's no punishment. And as I indicated earlier, you know, in the White case, they say if there's no lawful punishment, there's no way that you give effect to whatever offense there is. This, in regard to the second point, very briefly, this man's being restrained on $750,000 worth of bond. The evidence in the case indicates that he's 17 years old. He'd never been convicted of a crime, never lived outside his parents' home, didn't have a job, has no resources, and his parents are not going to apply any of their resources, or his father's not going to apply any of his resources to the making of a bond. He has no ability to make a bond. The issue, in my mind, in regard to the reasonableness of it, is the court's consideration of the capital murder charge in assessing the amount of the bond, and in the court's admission of the pretrial of the what's alleged to be the defendant's statement. Article 1715 of the Code of Criminal Procedure sets out those issues, those types of considerations the court can set and can consider in setting the amount of bail. Ex parte Scott, which cited in my brief, talks about other considerations, and ex parte Rubick, which is also cited, talks about the consideration of the defendant's record and personal circumstances. Ex parte Hunt, which is cited in the state's brief, says that you can consider the nature of the offense and the potential sentence, the possible punishment in the case. How in the world do you take into consideration the possible punishment of a case where there is no possible punishment can be applied to it? As regards to the second subpoint, the admission of the defendant's statement, 35 years of practicing law, I've never seen this happen in this way, where the state stands up and says, we're going to offer this document as the statement of the defendant. There is no showing of any voluntariness. Article 3821 says it's a blanket prohibition. You do not admit a defendant's statement against him unless it's shown to be voluntary. 3822 says that it's not admissible in any criminal proceeding unless those showings are made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Llewellyn.
Thank you. May it please the court. It's good to see you all again. I'd like to start off by addressing some of the concerns that the court addressed to Mr. Moore in his presentation. He basically says, how do you give effect to the Supreme Court's ruling? Well, a trial court doesn't impose a unconstitutional sentence. We don't have those facts. We're not at that procedural posture yet. We haven't even had a trial. We don't know if he's guilty of anything at this point. That's the whole point that Justice Cochran in the Lykos opinion was pointing out. You don't get the cart before the horse. We are in the context of a pretrial habeas corpus. You can't argue about, hypothetically or academically, about whether or not we should impose a particular sentence. If we did, would it be constitutional? Is this the right thing to do?
No, it's already been determined that it's not constitutional. So nobody's asking whether it's constitutional. There is no constitutional sentence, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, under the Texas scheme. So you tell me what the range of punishment for a death penalty, for a capital case for a 17-year-old is, after the Supreme Court has spoken.
Death or life without parole. There's nothing that can be lawfully imposed, but the statute still on the books is death or life without parole. If you were to impose either one of those, slam dunk out of here in a heartbeat, and it should be. In fact, a trial court shouldn't even impose those.
Well, what can the trial court impose? Because those are the only lawful sentences, unless you amend your indictment.
Yes, ma'am, Your Honor, I completely agree with that. But the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court did not say Texas or any state, you cannot prosecute them. You have to take all your capital murder statutes off the book. You have to go into a capital murder hiatus until your legislatures can fix the statute or the punishment ranges if your states provide for this type of thing. They didn't even declare that capital murder or this type of problem was unconstitutional. They addressed specifically as an Eighth Amendment matter, are these cruel and unusual punishments? Yes, they are. You cannot do that to a minor. You can't impose those sentences to a minor. It didn't say that you can't indict, that a prosecutor can't seek an indictment, or that a trial court can't try those particular offenses in the interim. But what I'm saying is, my whole point being, is that all of that is a hypothetical, it's non-concrete at this point. None of that has happened, because the Supreme Court didn't say, respectfully, Your Honor, in those opinions, that it did not say the prosecution cannot seek an indictment. A state cannot allow citizens to be prosecuted for something in interim change periods of the law where it's all in flux based on their opinions, that you can't do that. It's just you can't impose those types of sentences against that age defendant. We haven't imposed any sentence on anyone at this point. I'm just saying, from a procedural standpoint, in the mechanism and the vehicle in which we find ourselves here today, I have to deal with what is. And what is that, is this a cognizable issue? Is this a ripe issue? Is this a situation where we are not authorized to proceed forward? I don't see the logical leap between a Supreme Court opinion that says we can't lawfully impose sentence X and Y against this particular age defendant when we... what I'm saying is that particular situation does not apply because we haven't tried anything yet. There's, I think, a big gap in the logic between you can't impose a sentence to you can't prosecute somebody.
Do you remember the time between Furman and Brooks?
Yes. Oh, it was a nightmare. I completely agree. I'm just saying that...
How many people tried death penalty cases after Furman v. Georgia before the Charlie Brooks case?
I couldn't answer that, Your Honor. I'm not sure.
Zero.
Okay.
Because there was no lawful death penalty sentence. So they didn't try those cases because there was no lawful sentence.
And that was also the point I was trying to make in the brief, Your Honor. I completely agree with that, is that this is the prosecutor's call to make. This isn't a trial court having the inherent authority to tell the prosecutor what it can and cannot do. I'm not saying that this is a power struggle between the DA's offices and the trial courts, but really that's kind of what this all boils down to. The trial court's authority is defined by law to resolve this particular type of issue. What remedies does it have? What authority does it have? Based on the legal landscape and the factual landscape, which I would argue we don't really have one of those yet because there wasn't technically any evidence admitted before the court on with regard to the first point of error below. But it is, well, we have all this authority that says the prosecutor thinks he's got PC to believe that somebody's committed an offense. Go to the grand jury. Present your case. Grand jury agreed with us. We now have a lawful indictment returned by a legally constituted grand jury. We have cases that say state's entitled to its day in court to try to prove the guilt of a particular person, to hold someone accountable, to enforce its state law. That is where we are. What does the trial court's authority with regard to how the prosecutor runs his business? Well, he smacks him down if he does something illegal, if he does something contrary to the law and the evidence, contrary to the Supreme Court opinion. I submit that if we had a trial tomorrow, and we convicted him of capital murder, the trial court could not impose either sentence. It would be unconstitutional either way.
So is that a void sentence or avoidable sentence?
Once instituted, it would be absolutely void, I would suggest. But again, we're not to that point yet, and that's the whole point, is that we are a pretrial, trying by evidentiary pretrial hearing to fix a problem that the legislature hopefully is in the process of doing it right now. If they don't present us one, then yes, I completely agree. It's incumbent upon us as prosecutors not to do an illegal act just like it is the trial court. That is something that we are going to, a bridge we will have to cross if June comes and goes and we don't have a law on the book that fixes 1231 of the Penal Code.
How can it fix it if it, at the time of the commission, I mean, you a person is punished according to the law at the time the offense was committed. And a change in the punishment can be used retroactively only if it benefits the defendant. Tell me how any sentence is a benefit to a defendant who is facing no sentence.
Because the analysis is, we didn't really get into that. This is kind of separate beyond, but to answer your question, it's going to be our position that you must, for the analysis that the courts have given us, you have to look at the statute as written now, death or life without parole. Yes, there's Supreme Court authority that says you can't impose those, but you look at that when you're assessing ex post facto. What's the sentence that's provided for at the time of the crime? Life or death without parole. Now at the time of imposition of sentence upon conviction, what does the law say? Law says life with parole. I would submit that life with parole is less than life without parole. That's the rest of your natural life. So having the possibility of parole is less than never ever having a chance to ever get out again.
Well, rather than holding him indefinitely, hoping the legislature will someday act in the way you want the legislature to do, why don't you just amend the indictment?
We certainly could have done that. We could have rendered this whole thing moot. We still
yes,
could.
Yes, just add count two.
Isn't the indictment charging him with murder as well?
Yes, that's also
so
part of
the practical effect of this is he's charged with murdering two human beings. If the bond that is set is reasonable for the allegations of murdering two human beings, how is he being unlawfully restrained?
That's my point, Your Honor. And coupled with, he's only attacking a sentencing statute at this point. He hasn't been sentenced to anything. There is no restraint under 37071. We are restraining him under 1903, the state's penal capital murder statute, which he does not attack in, or even mention or even cite in his writ or in the briefs, anything else. That's my point. There is no lawful restraint. That's why there's no cognizable type claim here.
Well, I think Justice Gabriel asked about holding him under the murder statute.
Yes.
Not capital murder.
I agree. The alt opinion that's in the brief was the DWI. There were two different counts of DWI, different manner or means, different ways of committing DWI. He only attacked the constitutionality of count two, but not count one. So they're saying, okay, if we can't grant you habeas relief, because if we were to strike, you win, we struck that indictment paragraph, there's still a count of DWI charging you in a different way that you don't challenge, still present in the indictment. Here I have a three-count indictment. Count one, capital murder. Count two, murder of one of the two individuals. And count three, murder of the second individual. So therefore, even if we were to say, yes, state of Texas, you can't do that, we got an inter order striking paragraph one under some remedy, we still have a murder indictment. He hasn't challenged that. He's still under restraint of just a criminal charge, not a sentencing statute. Also, with regard to the bond issue, Your Honor, I don't characterize, and I may completely be missing the mark here, his argument attacking the amount of bond per se. I don't think he's inherently saying that $750,000 is improper or too high for the offense of capital murder. That's his point. It shouldn't have been set for capital murder. It should have just been set for murder. And yes, a court, in my opinion, can go ahead and say if $750,000 for an indictment that charges two deaths, and if that's a reasonable amount, then the trial court didn't err. I don't interpret his argument as being that way. It's that because you set it for capital instead of regular, then you erred there, and two, you also erred in setting the amount of bond because you received this evidence and considered this evidence that you shouldn't have been considering. So If the court wished to resolve the matter in that way, I think it's perfectly permissible to do that. Because I didn't get into, well, is this appropriate amount? And going through other cases have said that $750,000 in a capital murder case is okay, because I didn't see him arguing inherently that $750,000 is unreasonable. It was just the process whereby the trial court set this bond was unreasonable. It set it for a capital murder case instead of murder, because it should have granted my first point of error. Struck the capital murder out of the indictment, left with two murder cases, now set bond judge for those two. And so I'm submitting that when the court followed Lykos and decided that it had no legal authority to even have an evidentiary hearing in a pretrial setting, therefore I can't strike count one, the capital, out of the indictment. Therefore, I now must set bond. That's the second ground to ask for. So now I'm looking at an indictment. I have capital murder and murder. It's a capital murder indictment. I'll set bond for capital murder. That's what I did as the judge. So, you know, that I think was the process that the judge had to go through at that point. Since he denied the relief striking the capital murder, he still had a capital murder indictment to set bond for. He did set bond for. And the only argument I see is that, well, the judge unreasonably set that bond because he set it for capital, when that's not the righteous offense that should have been charged, because you denied my first requirement for relief. Therefore, in that sense, it's unreasonably set, not that $750,000 for a capital murder case is inherently too high based on the evidence that was presented. I know I didn't go through the traditional analysis that you're supposed to with regard to that. And the way the standard of review for this court is you look at the evidence, look at the statutory criteria, see if they match up, and if the judge acted, you know, in an arbitrary and capricious manner, or just basically missed the boat, then you go ahead and reform the amount of bond. But long and short of it, as far as the bond is concerned, I didn't interpret his argument as being that. It's just it was unreasonably set in the manner in which it was, because the court considered evidence it shouldn't, and then two, it set it for an offense that it shouldn't have ever been setting it for, because it should have granted the first request and struck that out altogether. Again, this all boils down to, as far as the state's concerned, is what is the trial court's authority? What remedy does this trial court have to stop a state from seeking a, from continuing to prosecute and to seeking a trial its day in court on a lawfully turned indictment? Court of Criminal Appeals for decades has said that if a valid indictment on its face presented by a grand jury, that's enough alone to submit it to trial. And that's all we're asking the court to follow with regard to that. Now, there are a lot of other hypothetical problems I see because of the procedural context or the vehicle appellant used to get this before the trial court. He did it in a writ. Because he did it in a writ, then it's an extraordinary remedy. You've got to come in and specifically ask for that. And if what appellant is saying here today, and I'm completely incorrect as far as how I categorize his argument, let's just call it and throw it under the umbrella of general due process. It's a due process claim. You can't prosecute me because there's no valid statute on the books. There's still technically a valid statute or sentence on the books, life or death without parole. It just can't, according to the Supreme Court, be lawfully imposed. I still have a statute. I still have a sentence. It's just if we have a conviction, we're months away from that. And again, that's why you don't litigate this stuff pretrial. You have to wait till after there's an actual conviction. Until he's convicted of something, then all of this really is an academic exercise, in my opinion. Therefore, it's not ripe. When a claim's not ripe, the court has no jurisdiction to hear the claim. Because he didn't come into court and say, Judge, I just want this generic order of prohibition ordering the state that they can't proceed. He attacked count one. I want to be relieved from restraint from count one of the indictment. Well, how would you go about that? It's tantamount or the equivalent of a dismissal or a quashing of the first count. We remove that. We're going to cut that out of the indictment altogether and proceed accordingly. I, yes, selfishly want to have it termed as a dismissal, because then I have explicit statutory authority to appeal a dismissal of a part of my indictment. But if this just generic order saying that state you can't proceed, even though the grand jury that has not been argued has unlawfully imposed or returned this indictment that lawfully charges a statute that's not currently under attack, you can't proceed on that to trial because the Supreme Court said you can't punish him for that. I'm supposed to sidestep and not consider the legislature fixing that? We're not on the eve of trial yet. And in effect, it's granting an injunction keeping us from being able to lawfully exercise our prosecutorial discretion. So that is why I submit that the trial court did the right thing. It did not have legal authority, followed binding precedent as I presented to the court, and it summarily denied the writ without receiving evidence, and I believe that is correct under the law and the authorities that I presented to the court. So unless you have some other questions, I'm going to shut up. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Llewellyn. Rebuttal, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honor, very briefly. Justice Dauphineau points out in 1972, when Furman versus Georgia and Branch versus Texas were decided, that ended. Every state in the, every death penalty state in the country still had a statute on their books, but the punishments were not constitutional, and there wasn't a single death penalty trial until new statutes were enacted. To say, and I just cannot fathom, to say that the issue is not ripe for review until he's been actually tried, convicted, and sentenced to an unconstitutional sentence just defies logic. There's some issue, you know, there's some case law, ex parte Watkins, that deals with, you don't have to actually release him from custody in order for you to get a pretrial habeas finding. In Watkins, the issue was sudden passion had been litigated in the first trial, and they were bringing him up to retry him on the second case. And what the issue in Watkins was is not whether or not they could retry him in the second case, because it was everybody understood that they could. The issue was whether or not they could, the state could force them to relitigate the sudden passion issue. And the court determined, no, you can't. That's already been decided, and you can't force them to relitigate that issue. And so Watkins is important in that particular regard. In regard to Mr. Llewellyn's issue with what the complaint in the second point error was that the bond was not set in a reasonable amount. That's what the brief says. That's what the argument says in the brief, that the amount of $750,000 was excessive in this case based on the facts that the judge heard. Now, that what becomes an issue is some of those facts we don't think should have heard. That statement should have never been admitted under the circumstances under which it was admitted.
You say you've never seen that in your practice of the law. Have you ever seen a police report admitted without any kind of predicate, any kind of sponsoring witness,
Absolutely.
And all the attachments? What's the difference?
Because there's a specific statute. The rules of evidence have a hierarchy. It's set out in Rule 101 of what rules take precedence. Constitutional law and statutory law takes precedence over the rules of evidence. So a hearsay recitation in a police report is something that the rules of evidence might prohibit, but they don't apply in the bond hearing. An issue when you're talking about a defendant's statement, as I indicated earlier, 3821 says you do not admit it. And there's no prohibition in 3821 under what types of proceedings. It's a blanket prohibition. You don't admit it against him unless it's shown to be voluntary, and it's their obligation to make that showing. And they didn't do it in this case. 3822 talks about proceedings. There's some old cases that talk about that definition of what proceedings means, but it certainly doesn't mean the defendant's trial. It means any criminal proceeding. And those statutes take precedence over any rule of evidence that might apply. And since the rules of evidence don't apply, that does not mean that the statute and the Constitution of the United States don't apply. And that's the problem with it trying to admit that statement in that fashion. I have never seen that. I have looked and not found a single case, reported case anywhere, where that was done at all, even that there was a complaint made about it. Thank you. We appreciate your time. We realize that y'all can't grant oral argument in every case, and we appreciate y'all doing it in this one. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Your case is submitted. We appreciate you being here today in court to present your arguments. And, of course, we appreciate all your briefing in this matter. So your case is now submitted, and that being our only argument for this morning, we will adjourn court. Thank you.